Berylum Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sports Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome once again to Verulam Sport Podcasting, the personal highlight of my week, and I know it's yours too. And this week, I'm really looking forward to this one. I know I say that every week, but truly I do. I think it's just so exciting. But we're doing something I think quite important this week in Verulam Sport Podcasting. We are shining a light, singing, banging the drum for unsung sporting heroes. We love sporting heroes. So many of them get so many praise, they're almost idols. But there are so many great stars across all sports who do remarkable things, but maybe without that limelight, without that glory. Many of these guys are actually characters who don't seek that. Well, seek it or not, ready or not, here we come, because we think it's about time that some of these great stars get the great praise that we're going to bestow upon them today. And as always, it's your show every single bit as much as it is ours. So as always, keep the machine busy across social media. Tweet us at Verulam Sport. We love to hear from you. And I know you've got opinions and thoughts on your own favourite unsung sporting hero or indeed heroine. Get involved. Keep them coming. And I know, going now to my friend, the machine, Jason McKenna. How are you? And how busy has our social media feed been on unsung heroes?
You know what? I think what this really taps into and what I really love about this, Tony, is that it taps into the psyche of the underdog that I think so many people absolutely love. But as always, people have kept me busy on the social media. And there were quite a few here that I didn't even think of. Nigel has actually pointed out quite a recent one with Tottenham Hotspur. And he said Moussa Dembélé was perennially undervalued by Tottenham, and now they're suffering because of it. So I suppose he's probably thinking that they haven't replaced him as well. Michael has mentioned, I think somebody that you've talked about in the past, Tony, Dixie Dean. He smashed all sorts of goal scoring records. Then other names that were thrown into the pit there, Damon Hill, Colin Montgomery, Jamie Murray, Trevor Woodman, and Darren Goff, just to name a few. But I think Anne has kind of put a really important point here, and something that we always champion on Verulam Sport, that female athletes as a whole seem to be unsung heroes because quite often their story is overlooked. And, you know, I think we can definitely get behind that one there, Tony.
Yeah, 100%. And I'll tell you what, if you haven't heard it, do check out the podcast we did last week with Jess King, the newest acquisition and ambassador for Kickoff at Three, a professional footballer. She's currently plying her trade at Lewis, but she's been all over the world, started out at Liverpool, and she's a very excited Liverpool person at the moment, as I'm sure most of Merseyside, or at least the red side of Merseyside, is. Congratulations to Liverpool. First championship, first Premier League ever, first division or highest league title since 1991. So many people weren't even born then. Goodness me. But coming back to that podcast, she's got some awesome things to say about equality and the importance of female sport. And it's a great podcast. Do check it out. And always, it is something that we champion here. But Jason, I want you to champion something new, as well as what you do awesomely always for us here on Verulam Sport Podcasting, and all that awesome social media work and data crunching and just your sheer passion and commitment is astonishing. But I want you now to champion, to take a front seat. Don't be an unsung hero. Step up to the plate and tell us all about where we can listen to all the hard work that you've been doing recently for the Verulam Sport, Radio Verulam, Flower Show. Tell us a little bit more on how we can get engaged and listen in.
Yes, so thank you very much, Tony. In terms of the eFlowers show, I do have a passion for gardening. Amongst many other things, I'm a man of many kind of different skill sets, but I just wanted to do something. Obviously, in lockdown, we all have a little bit more time, and I thought I'd focus it on something positive. And also, I was missing the Chelsea Flower Show. So I was actually sitting there one day with my gran. We'd got the refund from the show, and we were kind of sad about it all. And I thought, well, what can I do to fill the horticultural hole in my life? And I had the brainwave, you know, one of those eureka moments. And I thought, well, why don't I make one myself? So we kind of been working on it together. She's actually been my camera person all throughout, so all those kind of funny silly videos, she has been there doing it all. And obviously I've done the editing and stuff, but she's been part and parcel of the team. So
Nana McKenna, we salute you. I know she listens. I know she's a big fan, and just all the great work that she's been doing. You and Clan McKenna as a great team doing great things, and it's an awful lot of hard work, Jason. I know you put your heart and soul into this one. It is massively appreciated. It's going to culminate tomorrow. Can you tell us where and when we should be listening into this? And you donning your not only Alan Titchmarsh shoes, but also your very talented broadcasting perspective.
So yeah, tomorrow or whenever this goes out, it's going to be Saturday, the 4th of July, 6 p.m. And what I've been really ambitiously working towards is a concurrent broadcast where it's both on radio and live on the internet at the same time. So you can listen on radio if you're out and about and you can't watch on, you know, whatever device you have. But if it's safe to do so, pick up a screen and watch it, because we've got some really beautiful flowers. It's on YouTube, so it's going to be Radio Verulam YouTube channel. It's all going to be across social medias tomorrow, so that you can build up towards it all day and think and maybe make your guesses who's going to win those prizes. But in terms of it, it's really easy to do. You just go radioverulam.com or social media, or just type into YouTube Radio Verulam, and it will be there waiting for you to enjoy. And I hope, you know, obviously we have a lot of sport on tomorrow, but I think we placed it at a nice time when the sport is over, and obviously people listening to this podcast will think, what can I do? Let's have a little bit of jolly fun watching the flowers.
Get involved. And I'll tell you what, Jason, we're now going to unleash the unsung heroes. You mentioned the Chelsea Flower Show. Unless I'm much mistaken, there's a Chelsea connection to your first unsung hero. Tell us more.
Oh, that's a lovely segue there, Tony. Absolutely elite level stuff. And we're talking about an elite level enabler, just like yourself, but with Claude Makélélé. Now, I think that it's a career of underappreciation. I think it, in terms of it, I think Claude will sit there smug face, because I think now people are looking at him. But I remember him arriving at Chelsea in 2003, and a lot of people were kind of questioning, oh, well, what have Chelsea spent a lot of money on here for? He wasn't attractive in the sense he wasn't a goal scorer, he wasn't an assist machine. He was just this guy, and a lot of people kind of question it. But then he has moulded the defensive midfield role into his own. And kind of testament to the fact is that Real Madrid didn't appreciate him. But once he left, there was a big hole in their midfield, and it caused a lot of problems there. But what I love about the story of Makélélé is he was a true utility kind of player. He used all of his assets, and he was a converted winger. So amazingly speedy, which was mixed with an amazing ability, an intelligent player who could read the game, make tackles, blocks, interceptions that were so, so important. But what was important about the Makélélé role, he was the deepest midfielder, but I think it's quite simple and maybe offensive to him to actually say that he was just a defensive anchor man. I would say that it's to say that is just to undervalue him once again. He was so important to transitional play. He was the assister of the assister. He would switch defence into attack, and he was always forward thinking with his pass. You wouldn't often see him make a sideways or backward pass. And what was amazing about him as well was his passing ability, raking balls across the field. He could find any player, set off an attack, or set off the player that was going to set off the attack. And I kind of look at other players of the period. Gilberto Silva was probably another one that was, in air quotes, boring, but did such an important job. And now I think Makélélé was, you know, broke down those barriers, because we see N'Golo Kanté, Fernandinho, they're kind of valued. But I still think until probably one of those players wins a Ballon d'Or that people will realise what kind of level. But he revelled in the 4-3-3, and I have to admit that he would only probably work in a 4-4-3 or a kind of double pivot situation, which some would say limits him. But the fact that he dominated football in a time of transition under Mourinho and under probably Pep as well, it would be fantastic to see him today, Tony.
He's almost created the Makélélé position, again, in a very specialist role. A couple of few things there you've highlighted, and I think it's going to become a theme for tonight, is that with these unsung heroes, quite frankly, you don't always realise how precious they are until they are no longer there. As you say, the vacuum all of a sudden there at Real Madrid. Quite astonishing. He is a remarkable talent and very much an engine. But again, that's too simplistic. But his world-class value was this enabling quality. And in a game where there are places for all different styles, he stood alone as being able to destroy and then, as you say, pass the ball forwards. An upgrade on maybe the water carriers that preceded him, the likes of Dunga and Deschamps, etc., etc. Again, they had their value, they had their place. This defensive midfielder has always been part of the footballing culture, but he took it to a completely different level. Very unique, great engine, great shout, Jason. I love that for our first one of the night.
Yeah, just to add to that, in terms of facts, data, and kind of to embellish it a bit more for you, Tony, even though I don't think I need to, but he was integral to that Mourinho kind of dominance of the Premier League when he came. He was Mourinho's man in many ways. He was the embodiment of it. And I think the fact and data that would speak out for me is the fact that he was the defensive midfielder that shielded that Chelsea defence that conceded the least goals ever in Premier League history. So I think that kind of says it all for me. But I'm dying to see who you've got up next, Tony. Who's your undervalued sport?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to go for Justin Rose, the English golfer. And this might surprise some people, but honestly, I don't think this guy gets anywhere near enough credit. And I'll predicate that argument with this, okay? Now, in 2013, it was a great year for English and British sports. He won his first and at the moment only major at the 2013 US Open that was played at the Merion Golf Club out in America. And that was the first time an Englishman had won a major in golf since what many regular listeners will recall, one of the things that got me into golf, one of my favourite moments of sporting theatre, when Sir Nicholas Faldo hunted down the great white shark of Greg Norman to win his third Masters way back in 96. So that's over 13 years since then. There was this little bit of a monkey. However, that coincided that year with not just a monkey, but an absolute behemoth of a gorilla off the back when Sir Andrew Murray won Wimbledon the first time in 77 years, of course, since Fred Perry, a male champion of Wimbledon. But because of that, it just felt like all of this wonderful exposure that was there and available to Justin Rose was ripped asunder. I'm not saying that that was unfair, because we recognise the importance of Wimbledon to the British sporting psyche. But again, it's not 77 years, but 96 to 2013 is not a short span. And again, he paled into insignificance by dint of comparison. Now, the reason I begin with that is because once again, it's another kind of omission for me. literally on that regard. On the BBC website, 20 years now, they've been up and running. They're doing a wonderful poll of asking us to have our favourite choices of their favourite memories in all sport for the last 20 years, of 2000 to present day. Great idea. Love it. It's got some eclectic, people in there. Again, great that they shine a light and give an exposure to lots of Paralympians in there. It's very diverse. But to me, conspicuous by its absence, there was only one in 2013. There's numerous from many other years, but only one in 2013. Justin Rose's only major win. Again, the first Englishman to claim a major since Faudo, 96. No Justin Rose on this list. For me, that makes a very stark announcement and is, again, testimony to my point that he doesn't get the recognition that he truly deserves. Now, let me break down why he deserves so much more recognition. I just am in awe of his consistency. As well as that, at the moment, just one major win. He's in the last 5 years has placed second at the US Masters in 2015 and then again second in 2017. And you know, Jason, I say it all the time, winners win. Second place is the best loser, one could argue. But it's still high quality when you're playing at the highest level there. And a second place also in the 2018 British Open. I mean, just what a run. If you go back to 2013, that's one win, one major win. Again, the first Englishman, and it hasn't been replicated by an Englishman since. And then three second places in the majors after that, and no end of top 10 finishes throughout those tournaments. Just a model of absolute consistency. And golf is a game which is so full of quirks, so intense under the mental pressures, that to obtain that consistent success, that's a sustained level, is absolutely astonishing. Okay. Now, he is one of only 23 players all time to rise up to the level of the number one ranked golfer on planet Earth. That's since the records began in 1986. So once again, he's in elite company. He also, when he won gold in the Olympics in Rio, which he really enjoyed, you saw him, he just loved getting involved with the whole atmosphere of that Rio Games, cheering on our swimmers, getting behind our athletes. He was a real ambassador. And I tell you something, this also puts in him a real elite club. That meant that was a win in a major recognized official tournament. And that was a win for him, Justin Rose, in all six continents on planet Earth. Only five other golfers all time, all of whom are Hall of Famers, have that claim. So Rose joins the rank of Gary Player, David Graham, Hale Irwin, and Bernard Langer. Only five golfers all time have won a tournament, officially recognized tournaments, across all six continents on the planet. Another thing that I really, really admire him, I talked about that consistency and that kind of focus, but his career hasn't been without its trials and its tribulations. And always, I think it's through those that you really do get the measure of one's character. So he announced himself onto the scene, exploded onto the scene in the 1998 Open Championship, where as an amateur, he fought his way through the ranks and finished a very creditable fourth place. And everybody could see that this young lad, who I think was only about 18 at the time, had such a great natural swing, such immense talent, that it was almost like he was destined to be great. And it took many, many years before that even came close to fruition. He struggled very much in his early pro career. In fact, didn't make the cut in his first 21 events. And then in 2005, again, we were talking about that consistency of success. It was a consistency of well, the opposite of success, borderline disaster. He slipped out of the world's top 100, but then came roaring back. And he hasn't looked back since. Consistent performer, England's first major winner since Faro 96. And since then, no Englishman has even really challenged. So, Justin Rose, you were omitted from the BBC Sports website's 20 best memories of the last 20 years in sports. You are, though, welcomed to Verum Sports' unsung hero list. Jason, quickly, your thoughts on Justin Rose?
I love that, and I think the way that you've explained it as well, he seems to have been maybe unlucky or just damn well overlooked in terms of history books there, because it is that kind of record for an Englishman, once again, once you said the kind of link there with the history. And also, I think the fact that he won gold at the Olympics, the first golf there since 1904, I think that should be a huge achievement kind of celebrated in itself. To win gold at the Olympics whenever, but to be the first for so, so long should be celebrated. In terms of Justin Rose, I think you've made a credible and brilliant kind of argument. But what do you think will happen in the next few seasons or years in terms of golf? Do you think that he will be able to kind of reach that standard? Because we look at the people like McIlroy, Tiger Woods, and kind of others that have lifted the tournaments, and he's done it himself. But where has he slipped up or maybe not achieved enough to be able to be in that kind of group of individuals?
It's a great, great question. And again, he's always in contention. And as I say, for me, one of the emblems of true great sports people is consistency. Loads of people appear on the scene and then fizzle away. Loads of people across all sports demonstrate moments of genius, but then can't apply it consistently. And there's a space for all of them. We love a maverick, and we may chat mavericks in the near future. But for me, he is almost the antithesis of a maverick. And that's, again, his character. It's maybe one of the reasons he's not as sung as he should be, because he doesn't seek the limelight. He's very softly spoken and just a very decent chap. Look, the game of golf is moving forwards at such a rate of knots. There are so many world-class players out there. But Justin Rose, I'm sure, will always feature. And then on another day when the stars are aligned, I think he will take that consistency and push it to another major before it's all said and done. Again, so many seconds. And as I say, and you know, winners win. But he is a proven winner as well. He's got that memory to recall and drive him on. And for me, he will be always in contention, and that means he's always got a good chance. At the end of the day, you always want to be there or thereabouts going into the fourth round of a major. We spoke, obviously, as you know, again before that, 96, Nick Faldo, the moment that I fell in love with the game. I won't go into too many details, but Faldo hunted it down. But again, he had to at least be in contention. So many people just simply have a great round one day, and then they can't replicate that. So Rose has this mental fortitude to keep his cool, to keep his swing in control. He's very, very control. I would say maybe that is the most apposite word to associate with him. And that control and that mental fortitude mean, for me, he will always be in contention. I think he's got every chance of claiming at least one more major before it's all wrapped. I think that's time to wrap that up, and I hope people appreciate that we have sung the praises of Justin Rose, who I think is eminently unsung until now. But obviously, there's loads more where Rose came from. Jason, what's up next?
Well, from Rose to Roseburg, we're talking about an F1 driver, and I think you've actually really hit on a point that I wanted to talk about with Rosberg. But I think it's an overarching theme with quite a few of the people that we've mentioned and that we're going to talk about, you know, you're going to bring on a little bit later as well. And I think these people are unsung heroes, not only because maybe they've won, but the consistency is there, but maybe not 100% at the top. You know, so Justin Rose is consistently good and has won major tournaments, but he's not done a Tiger Woods where people just talk about him because he's ridiculously good. But he's not also mentioned because they're just seen as non-characters in many ways. They're neutral and they're so dedicated to their sport that many people kind of class them as boring. But for me, in my eyes, I think that they're just so dedicated to their craft, to becoming better. And it might be because they might not be the most skilled at it, but if they become the most dedicated, then your kind of truism that you say so many times, Tony, the more I work on it, the luckier I get. And I think that is kind of the, not problem, but the kind of identity of a lot of these unsung heroes, that they just work so hard at their craft that they become synonymous with that, and they're kind of the boring person. And like I said there, from Rose to Rosberg, I think this is something with him as well, until his final season, which is why I put him on this list. Now, before we kind of jump into that 2016 title-winning season, there's some clear facts here that I think people have to take into account that show that Rosberg, his character, but also his driving ability, has to be up there with the best. He went to Mercedes in kind of a bold career move before they'd really established themselves. So once again, I would say that makes him a great in many sense because he had great loyalty. You know, those first few seasons at Mercedes, he was a very good driver, and I'm sure lots of other teams came knocking, but he stuck with them, and he was actually quite integral to the process of improving them. But my other point is that in those early days of Mercedes, who was he vying against? Seven-time world champion Schumacher. And not only did he vie against him, he came on top every single season. Now, in my eyes, obviously Schumacher was a little bit older, but to consistently beat Michael Schumacher, not something to be sniffed at. But we also move on to seven-time world champion, to six-time world champion Lewis Hamilton. Rosberg is only one of two teammates to beat Hamilton across a whole season. And obviously that's the aforementioned 2016 season. What I would also say in terms of F1, I think he brought out some of the best, most competitive F1 driving we've seen for many years because he really pushed Hamilton in all his seasons. We saw the best driving from Hamilton to beat him, but we also saw some of the best driving from Rosberg to beat Hamilton. And a lot of people will say that Rosberg was lucky to win in 2016, but I think with any kind of winning in sport, there is luck to it. Hamilton had car issues, but Rosberg came into his own. He mastered his tactics, his driving ability. He focused on himself. And I think there was this edge to him as well, which some would describe as being nasty, maybe scumbaggery, like those kind of adjectives there to his driving ability. But he got almost this anger and drive in him that, no, this is my season. And he took it by the horns and he wrestled it and he came out on top. So I think the vintage year did come at the right time. It was lucky, but I would say that it was luck because he kind of made it his own. So I'd say that there's one final point. I think that he's an unrecognized hero. And he bowed out right at the top. He didn't kind of spoil his lineage. He didn't try and continue on for far too long. But also, and I think it was kind of humbling and really nice to see, Rosberg stopped because he wanted to be with his family. He got what he wanted. He didn't want to risk his life, his health. He was just happy. And I really respect that. I think, obviously, a one-time world champion, but you only have to be the world champion once, and you're the world champion forever. So, for me, he's an unsung hero for many reasons. His values, his ability. But, moreover, it's just that the fact that he has vied with the best and come out on top. And I think that history doesn't really always take that into account.
Jason, I'll tell you what, that is a wonderful account, and I think you made a really, really powerful case then. I definitely think it's a man who certainly is not receiving the due respect necessary. I'm going to ask a question, and then we'll go back to that controversial season, of course, his one and only world title. Well, again, Germany, you're there. You have the main man himself, Mr. Schumacher, and so on and so forth. Was he inspired by Schumacher, do you think?
Yes, well, this was actually something that I was going to bring up last week because obviously we talked about Schumacher and dynasties. But I saved it for this week because I thought, you know, I'm going to talk about Nico Rosberg. And I think it was a really kind of, once again, a humbling story and kind of an insight into what a character Schumacher was. And obviously I said there that he beat Schumacher every season. But Schumacher also made sure to look after Rosberg. He kind of took him under his wing. And a lot of people kind of attribute Rosberg's success by Schumacher. In many ways, he kind of taught him to be him in so many ways. And I think before Schumacher, and also a little bit after, Rosberg was the nice guy of F1. You know, he wouldn't say boo to a goose. And that's why 2016 really shocked a lot of people, because out of nowhere, you know, he was defying team orders. He was doing what was best for himself. And that's why he came out on top. But yes, undoubtedly, Michael Schumacher really shaped him. And that's why during and after Schumacher was there, Rosberg was kind of always at the factory. He was always talking to people, making them feel important. And he really got that humility from Schumacher, which was so important. But undoubtedly as well, he got a lot of driving ability. So a good question there.
Excellent stuff. And next thing then, we can't help but just drill into that controversial season, because I think it was richly earned. And again, there was that shift in mentality that you alluded to, maybe the notch up required to be the true champ. But there were an awful lot of mechanical problems that season. If I were to don a conspiracy theory hat, I'm not saying this is the case. I could never prove this to be so, but I'm just simply saying that there was a sense that that season, maybe things were rather favored, leaning towards Rosberg, as if to say, this is your season. Is that a little OTT?
I mean, you've got to factor in the fact that Hamilton had won the championship 2 out of the 3 seasons that he was there with Rosberg. So for the kind of conspiracy, I don't believe it, because you're potentially harming your best driver who would leave. He would leave if he knew that somebody else was being put on top of him. So for me, I just totally throw that out. I think it was just a very unlucky season for Hamilton. And I believe that when he signed, obviously Hamilton hadn't won for a very long time. But then he proved himself. He won the championship. And Rosberg was the kind of unspoken but de facto second driver. And they were probably just happy that, you know, that Hamilton's first car was doing badly. So they were happy that their other driver was doing well. So in my opinion, no, I don't really believe those conspiracies. Yes, he was a German in the German car for the German team. But I think Mercedes kind of look beyond that, because they want to win. And I'm sure if they could have, they would have had Hamilton and Rosberg vying once again. So I don't believe that one. And what I would also say as well with Rosberg, again, tying to his humility, in 2016, he'd actually signed a new contract with Mercedes, multi-million pounds, obviously, until 2018. And he gave that all up for his family. I just think it's a really nice story in terms of sport for sport's sake, but also realizing what matters most, and that's his family and loved ones.
Taking that priority. There is a case, and I'm slightly advocating the devil here, though, that when you've got that first one in the bag, that the real champions, the ones that have the utter commitment to their art, their gift, their skill, whatever the sport, are then pushed forwards. Now, I know the tragedy of so much sport is when people almost get so addicted to it that they just simply do not know when to walk away. But having gone through all of this challenges and nearlies and so closes to grab it, is there a sense that there could have been more? And maybe he had it in him to push on to then into another category out of the rather good into the bona fide great?
I think there's a few things at play there. First of all, I would say if you're world champ, you're world champ. You know, how many F1 or Drivers' World Champions have there been? You know, you can probably count them on a few hands, but it's not very much at all. And my second point would be is that he probably knew that he was second best to Hamilton in driving ability. And it takes a brave man, like you said there, Tony, to kind of admit that I had a fantastic season, I'm a brilliant driver, but Hamilton is once in a generation. And to not risk life and limb and kind of maybe seeing that, like I said a little bit earlier, that he's a people's champion in many ways, that he realised it's good winning, but me winning most is when I'm at home with my family. So I think he got the job done. He will forever and throughout all history be a world drivers champion, and you can't take that away.
You cannot, and we have sung his praises. I'm introducing now my final pick for today. And again, one of the kind of themes for tonight has been that with these unsung heroes, oftentimes their true influence, their true value, isn't actually when they are there doing their thing, but when they are taken out. Now that applies immensely to this next guy, Rugby World Cup winner, Richard Hill. Tell you what, I'll build up to that story, but just what a great player. His record is astonishing, really is. Of course, that England World Cup, but so many titles with Saracens. He was a one club man, which is even now very rare in this modern world. 71 caps for England, 12 tries, so a really good try to game ratio for a forward. And much as I'm going to explain the narrative of Richard Hill, who earned the moniker the Silent Assassin. And that was his game, particularly as he aged. But goodness me, as a youth, he was a tearaway, real great acceleration. And I remember he kept Neil back out of the open side position for England for many, many years before they almost formed the perfect, most balanced back row, you could argue, of all time. I'll talk about that trio, the World Cup winning three, in a moment. But just, I remember a try against France in his early England career where he just tore down the wing with such aplomb, such a speed. He would simply not be denied. It could have been a bona fide winger doing that. Astonishing. But really, he earned the moniker the Silent Assassin. He was the only player in the tenure of Sir Clive Woodward never to be dropped. He was that critical. And the thing about Richard Hill is that he was one of those players in the game of rugby where he was willing, capable, and ready to put his body on the line. There's an old maxim in rugby, not necessarily always a truism, but it runs like this. The forwards win the game and the backs simply dictate the scoreline. Now, in that theme, in that general principle, really, that victory is actually, you could argue, most critically dictated by what's known as the breakdown, when the tackle scenario occurs and it converts into a ruck. Because what the attacking side need to do is clear that quickly so they can get the ball and then move forwards, create the space. And that's how tries occur, generally speaking. What Richard Hill's gift was in as he evolved from this tearaway open into one of the greatest blindside flankers all time is that he was doing the dirty work, stuff that doesn't necessarily get a statistical recognition, doesn't necessarily flash up on the eyes of showreels or feedback loops or things like that, but just the commitment to slow that breakdown, maybe slightly nefarious ways. We call them the dark arts in rugby. But to be willing to put your body on the line, to slow up the ball, hold the ball when maybe one had ought not to be by the letter of the law. But it's this commitment to the team that saw him be so instrumental to England achieving that World Cup success. And that back row triumvirate of open side, then Neil Back came into the fold. Richard Hill shifted to six, where I would argue, amongst many, he could well make a world all-time 15 at six. And then Lawrence Dallaglio doing his thing with his unique skill set at eight. Such an ultimate cocktail of the perfect combined skill set required for your perfect World Cup winning back row. And Richard Hill was the silent assassin of those three. Again, in that World Cup, he was actually injured up until the semi-final. And Lewis Moody, Leicester Tigers Lewis Moody, who is a great, great rugby player, great, great flanker in his own right, filled the void. But upon being fit, there was only one England number six, Richard Hill. Just the guy is just a legend. He truly, truly is. But coming back to where I began this tale, again, that theme about you don't necessarily appreciate just how critical people like Richard Hill are until they are taken out. And in the British Lions tour of Australia 2001, the British Lions pulverized Australia in the first test. They were winning up until half time in the second test. Then Nathan Gray, very good centre, committed a very clear high tackle on Richard Hill, which in now modern rugby, that was now 17 years ago. I can see it in my head. It feels just like a heartbeat ago. But 17 years ago now, in a modern rugby world, that would almost certainly result in Nathan Gray being red carded. I say almost certainly, and I think you could almost take out almost, frankly. Okay, it was a very blatant high tackle that resulted in the silent assassin, the man who has made his game, his art, playing the dark arts, putting his body on the line, was concussed, missed the rest of the tour. Now, again, in context, Lions pulverize Australia. Test one, replete with number six, Richard Hill. Lions are up to half time with Richard Hill. After that second test, that crucial second test, which if the Lions had won, would have been a tour victory against the Aussies. Again, they were up going into halftime with Richard Hill on the pitch, taken out by Nathan Gray. They then swept something like 15 points in 6 minutes and actually overall won that second half. I think the final score was something like 34-13, something along those lines, and that it was actually Australia's biggest ever victory over the Lions. And then Australia, in the final test, the decider, won again. So no one man makes a team, obviously. We respect that. We understand that. But the vital elements, the control, the body on the line stuff, the real, true, hard man stuff that was Richard Hill's game was so crucial to each and every team he represented. And I think that illustrates the point, because again, he is not Mr. Bombastic. He is not somebody who wants to draw lavish attention to himself. Again, in his early days, great tries and this and that, but his overall pattern of play was very much almost the rugby equivalent of a Claude Makélélé, and doesn't draw the praise that he richly deserves. For me, for those reasons, Richard Hill, you're an unsung hero. I hope if you listen, you appreciate these words and understand I sing your praises highly. I'd make you my number six in my all-time World Rugby 15.
Oh, what a testament there to Richard Hill. And I think one thing that I wanted to bring up about him was his ACL injury in 2004. And then bravely, after 7 months of rehab and working on it, he made it into one of your favourite institutions, the Lion team. The Lions tour. And that shows you what a quality player, how amazing he was at such an age as well. You know, when the kind of aches and pains, an ACL injury, normally at that kind of age, is career ending. But he fought on, he wasn't going to give up. And he made it into that tour. And obviously, a knee injury kind of cut that short once again. But it's just a testament to him that he was so brilliant, such a high quality, high standard professional right up till the end. And he was needed until the end. And like you said there, he was so needed, but often overlooked. And that's kind of the mixture of these kind of heroes, that they're needed, they're integral parts of these teams, but they don't always do the most glorious job. But it's testament to the fact, like you said there, Tony, that the Lions were kind of overturned when he had to be taken off injured. And I think in that kind of situation, hopefully people realised what a wonderful and integral player he was to England's successes over, especially in that 2003 victory.
Which, of course, remains to date England's only Rugby World Cup triumph. And again, what a triumph. And I must say, just coming back to that back row, those three, Neil Back, your classic open side flanker all over the park. You've got Lawrence Dallaglio with just this kind of rugby wisdom and grit. And then Richard Hill, just silent assassin. I think that sums him up so well. And as I say, dead in line with the Claude Makélélé, which of course began our tests and our talks of unsung heroes. I'm sure there are loads more that we haven't been able to sing their praises of, but we think of them massively. I'm sure you've got your views. Tweet at Verum Sports. Anything to do with unsung heroes. Always, we want to get your views on Premier League. And of course, Liverpool are champions, but who will survive the dogfight? We're going to hear from Richard Walker, head of comms for Watford, as they bid to remain in the Premier League for a sixth season. They're, of course, tackling Chelsea Saturday. It's going to be a big one. Make sure you're listening as well, because we heard from head of comms from the Saints earlier this week, and he's going to tell us all about a wonderful international brand reference, brand provider from Hummel, 4-year deal. It's a great chat. Got a lot of time for that new head of comms. And I got a lot of time for you listening. Always appreciate your time and company. Always remember, it's your show, every single bit, as much as it is ours. So continue to keep involved. Look forward to more Verum Sport podcasting. But for now, take care, keep well, keep safe. Thanks for listening.